A healthy life starts with great sleep. Wake refreshed with Avocado's GOTS-certified organic green mattress, delivering breathable, back-loving support, natural materials from Avocado's own sustainable wool and latex farms, easy financing, a one-year sleep trial, and deep, restorative slumbers. Organic sleep awaits at avocadomattress.com.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had a life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, man, I've been waiting to talk to this guy for a very long time. You may know him from the band Better Than a Thousand. You may know him from Shelter. You may know him from Youth of the Day. You may know him from Reflex of Pain. You may even know him from Ray and Purcell. Ray Capo is on the show today. And trust me, this is why we do this thing. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can find me, and thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. You can find me on Twitter or, no, not even Twitter, sorry, whatever that, I'm not even on that thing anymore. So you can find me on Instagram, at @LeftForDamian. There are some, there's a YouTube page, there's a TikTok page, there's an Instagram page, there's a Facebook page. All of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. And we put up videos on there and I edit these things together that I find interesting from the show. And yeah, the other stuff gets thrown up there from time to time and you keep updated on what's going on in the world of Turned Out of Punk. So follow those. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have a show. We have a show in Toronto coming up in a couple weeks, and it's a free show, Dundas West Fest, like a street party. It's going to be a lot of fun. Find out more information over at fuckedup.cc or just on the internet. You know, Fucked Up Band, Google it. You know, it'll all come up. And that is it. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, a huge guest for me, Raghunath Capo, a.k.a. Ray Capo, is here, and this is someone who, as I said, had a massive influence on me as a young person growing up, being a fan of straight edge and being a fan of hardcore, and in particular, youth crew hardcore, and someone who I ideologically don't necessarily have the same worldview as, but someone who I have a deep, deep respect for, and also someone who has put a lot of time and thought into the world around them. So get ready for a fun conversation. Ray, of course, put out a fantastic book called From Punk to Monk, which you can pick up on all sorts of platforms. There's a great audiobook version of it too that you can listen to. And I strongly recommend listening to that if you haven't, or reading that if you're so inclined, because it is more than just sort of a punk book. It's a sort of life book and about Ray's kind of journey. But this is a punk podcast, so we take that and apply it to the punk rock stuff. And I think we have a good conversation. Ray will be playing with Youth of the Day coming up. They're going to be playing a show in New York City in Brooklyn, at the Meadows in July, on July 25th, and at the Lutheran Music Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, not just somewhere in the state. They're going to be doing that on July 26th. You can also find everything that Raghunath is up to on his link tree, which I'll have links to this in the description for this podcast. He's of Raghunath Yoga on Instagram. And I think there's also a Facebook page as well. You can check out Ray's long running podcast, Wisdom of the Sages, that he co-hosts. That has been, I think, going longer than Turned Out of Punk. I think quite a bit longer than Turned Out of Punk, maybe. But that's it. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. I could go on forever talking about this and setting it up for you. But that is what my new podcast with Nick Woge, I heard they stream live, is for, where we go through and kind of dissect stuff. But you can check that out on Wednesday on YouTube when it goes live on the Turned Out of Punk channel, or happens live on the Turned Out of Punk channel. And then you can download it the next day on those platforms. And believe me, we're going to have a lot to talk about after this episode with this one, This is going to be a fun one to talk about with Woj. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Ray Capo on Turned Out a Punk. Ray, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I feel like I've been building up to having you on, as I just told you. You're someone who I've been around being interviewed for many, many years in different circumstances, but someone I've never gotten to actually interview myself, and someone I've got a lot of questions for because you're a huge influence on me as a person and many other people that have been on this podcast.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I guess hopefully good influences. You could also influence a person in criminal ways as well.
Well, I think you influenced me in a really positive way. Like I'm no longer straight edge, but I think discovering in particular kind of the youth crew era of your stuff when I did,
yeah.
I think that led to me becoming who I am as a person. And even though I'm no longer straight edge, like it gave me structure as a young person where I wasn't partying, so I had to make my own fun, which was making zines or doing a radio show or playing in bands. And so, yeah, a very positive influence on me.
Where'd you grow up?
Toronto.
Oh, okay.
I'm friends with a lot of people you know up here. I'm sure they will come up over the course of the show. But
yeah, some great shows in Toronto.
Absolutely. Some legendary shows. But we got to start off the way they all start off, which is, Ray, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
It's all in my book.
Believe me, I've read your book, but we're going to go a little deeper on some of the nerdier punk stuff, I think, today.
Okay, yeah, good. Extract the nerd, because I didn't get into a lot of nerdy fanboy stuff that I could have got into, so I'll share it now. But I think it was just from wanting an alternative life from growing up in a suburb in Connecticut. And I had older brothers and sisters who lived in New York City. And the hardcore scene was just sort of emerging. Bands were just putting out records. There were not a lot of records out back then. Some bigger California bands like Dead Kennedys, Wasted Youth had 12-inch records out. But in New York, it was super rare. Matter of fact, I don't think there were any. There was, I had the Kraut single, the Misguided single, the False Prophet single. Heart Attack had a single. That was about it when I got into it.
Abused, I guess, Urban Waste.
Yep. Abuse and Urban Waste, but I remember when those came out. Those were all sort of trick punk and hardcore. But I saw Agnostic Front before their single came out. I saw Cause for Alarm before their single came out. I saw Urban Waste before their single came out. I saw the Beastie Boys before their single came out. The Young and the Useless just released a single. So it was a good time.
What about in Connecticut, like the Gustav record scene, I guess early Incas record scene, Lost Generation and those types?
I was friends with the guys from Lost Gen, but I knew New York hardcore before I knew Connecticut hardcore. Like in my book, I tell how I got on a podcast, a radio show from throwing rocks at a window in my hometown. There was a late night punk show. The guy invited me up. And then Brian from the Anthrax called me up and said, "Oh, you're in a band called Violent Children. Why don't you come play at this benefit we're doing at Pogo's in Bridgeport?" And I was like, there's a hardcore scene in Connecticut. I didn't really know about it because I would just get on a train and go to New York City. But there was a pretty thriving, cool underground scene. The best band, hands down, was a band called CIA. And they had a single out. They put a 12-inch out later that wasn't as good as the 7-inch. The 7-inch was next level. And everybody thought they were going to be, you know, the next Minor Threat. Back then, just Minor Threat had two singles out. But when CIA put out that single, it was like amazing. But it just never manifested. Band broke up. They reformed as a three-piece. It didn't sort of work as much as the other one. But this other band, Reflex from Pain, put a single out. I wasn't crazy about it, but they were a good, very good band, and they asked me to sing for them. I sang for them for a short time, and then they became a band called 76% Uncertain. And the Incas and Lost Gen, they were great, cool friends of mine. And it was sort of a cool, weird scene in Connecticut. But I got to see, at that point, I started getting dragged from New York back into the Connecticut scene, and I saw some really cool shows because every touring band would also want to come while they're on tour, like, where else can we play? So they'd play Bridgeport, and I got to see like Flipper, Circle Jerks, you know, Black Flag, JFA when that first record came out. It was great. It was a great time to be into all that stuff.
Connecticut, it's interesting because it is much more of kind of an artier scene, which I think you touch on in the book, certainly when in talking about Anthrax and being an art gallery. And like, you look at these bands and there is sort of an artier bend to like something like Chronic Disorder.
Chronic Disorder. They were buddies of mine, Chronic Disorder. They were sort of way out there in Connecticut's, you know, now we tour and we travel so much, but, that was like a whole other side of Connecticut. Where were they from? Like the eastern part of Connecticut. So they didn't hang out as much, although we were friends with them. We played with them. They had like a punk twist to it. But I think the art side really came in from Brian from Anthrax, who at that time, street art, graffiti, subway art became sort of popular. So he had an art gallery and a club in the basement, and that was the old Anthrax in Stamford. So that was, it was pretty cool. Eventually Anthrax became a bigger club in Norwalk. That was much better. That's during the Youth Crew era in 87, maybe that opened.
Yeah. Like in that early Anthrax period, did you ever see this band, the Saucers, play?
They can't remember.
Gustav Records. They're an interesting band because
I've never heard of Gustav Records. You mentioned it twice now. I don't remember that.
They put out the Chronic Disorder 12 inch originally.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
The 12 inch. Okay.
Yeah.
This is really back memory lane because
that's what I told you. This is a great companion to the book because I'm going to be digging into the book a lot, but then I'm thinking I'm also going to be digging in some way nerdier shit. But
yeah, go with it. I enjoy it because no one asked me these questions.
Gustav Records was Craig Bell from Rock from the Tomb from Cleveland, like the first punk band, in my opinion, ever. It was his label that he started when he moved to Connecticut. And his band was the Saucers, and it was one of the guys from Miracle Legion and the other guy from Dump Truck.
Okay, yeah, Miracle Legion and Dump Truck had they were sort of like the artier, you know. It was like, you got to understand, we're coming out of punk, and then after punk, so-called, is dead, so to speak, especially like the British punk, it's like, where is America going to go next? And I think people went in all different directions. They went into sort of dance rock, like In Excess or something like that, or Duran Duran, because you got to understand, even Duran Duran, which we would sort of think is like the most commercial music ever, when Duran Duran came out, that was completely like avant-garde, weirdo, non-commercial rock. Even the Go-Go's was like considered weird. Bunch of
they were
girls.
A punk band.
What's that?
They were a punk band. Like,
yeah.
Their first, there's that 12 inch that should have come out before they signed to the major label, which sounds like LA punk. Like they have demos where they were like, and obviously Belinda Carlisle's in the Germs, and they have connections to the Tech Stones and all these punk bands.
Yeah. So it was like everything was, so I felt like that's when I got into like an 81 and 82, and I just saw it like going into different directions. And I like the rebellion idea of punk. So I was like, well, what direction am I going to be in? You know? So I was still trying to feel out what my flavor was. So there was like noise rock. There was like alternative indie rock. And the bands you mentioned, Dumb Truck, and what was the other one? Miracle Legion?
Miracle Legion.
What was the guy's name who did that record company?
Craig Bell.
Okay. I'm thinking of somebody else. I knew somebody else from those bands. I can't remember what his name was. But anyway, it was like, by the time I got into, I had a moment where I was like, what am I into? Because I did sort of like, you know, I remember U2 was playing, even U2 was playing like clubs there. I think they might've played CB's. I know they played the Ritz. And I remember the Weekend. See, I was probably 15 or 16. So I was at the whim of like when I can get away from school. When it was okay to stay at my brother's house, my brother lived in Queens, and I remember one weekend, it was just like a lineup in New York City where I just randomly, can I go visit you, to my brother? Sure. So I remember like right around the corner from his house, he happened to live where all those hardcore bands lived, Kraut, Murphy's Law, it was like Jackson Heights area, later Token Entry, Sick of It All, stuff like that. But at that time, I remember Kraut playing on the corner from his house. I was like, this is unbelievable. I've got the Kraut single. And then there was at the Ritz, which always hosted all different types of music, Haircut 100, which was also weird, alternative English British type of thing, but completely, funky pop, whatever. It was just whatever was alternative, not playing at a stadium. And then that same weekend, the UK Subs. And the UK Subs were playing with the Young and the Useless. The night before, they were playing with the Bad Brains at CBGB's. And so then that was my first step into like hardcore music. I think that was like 1982, or at least going to a hardcore music live. Otherwise, I listened to some hardcore music with all the other plethora of late night radio stations that you'd play, where you're getting, you know, people playing everything from, Radio Birdman to Black Flag to whatever, Susie Sue. You know, you'd get these late night Bridgeport or Norwalk or Boston or NYU radio stations that I could pick up from Danbury, Connecticut.
Yeah, there's this legendary pressing of Can't Close My Eyes that showed up, I think largely in Toronto, that had blank B-side labels. And there's these storied, not blank anymore because you guys had written on them and decorated them. And there was one that was like Ray's favorite punk records. And
oh, really?
Yeah. And it was like
Radio Birdman, man.
It was something like that. It was like this really cool list of bands. Like you guys were into, and that's what always like fascinated me and kind of influenced me, I think, in what getting into this stuff is the fact that you guys were like deep head fans of this thing and weren't just like casual about it. Like you were like into
all this. We were obsessed with it all. We were completely obsessed. We were really obsessed with it all. But I can't remember how we got talking about that.
Well, I think
I'm okay with not following any particular trail on this interview.
Well, then I want to talk to you because you mentioned that, like, you have the Vatican Commandos all ready by the time you go to the radio show. That 7-inch or the demo tape was eventually reissued by Malcolm from Trash American Style, right?
I'll give you a little background of Vatican Commandos.
Vatican Commandos. Sorry, I meant Violent Children. I don't know why I said
Violent
Vatican.
Children.
Sorry, I get my V Connecticut bands confused all the time.
It's okay. Bill, who was the drummer of Reflex from Pain, he recorded all the bands in Connecticut. He recorded Violent Children. We did it all on high-speed cassette. That was the method of recording. He recorded Vatican Commandos. He recorded Reflex from Pain. He recorded another Connecticut band, which never put out a record, or maybe they did. I don't know. They were called Hours of Torture. They all went to a really upscale private school, Choate in Connecticut. But we were friends with them. Our first show we ever played with Violent Children was Violent Children, Vatican Commandos, Hours of Torture, Agnostic Front, Cause for Alarm, CIA, Reflex from Pain. And I think I might have mentioned this in the book, or it got cut out of the book. I can't remember, but it was raided. But right after our show, it was raided by the cops because we were all underage. We weren't supposed to be playing all ages shows. And so we all hid under the stage. And that was like the most exciting night of my life. You know, the day we got raided by the cops, they told us to hide under the stage. We waited there. Agnostic Front played on top of our heads. And this is before even Agnostic Front was that big. They were big in New York, but no one really heard of them because they had no record out then. So it's not like they were even headlining the show. They were just like one of them. Oh, you know who else played that show? I think Reagan Youth, Urban Waste played that show. It was like a whole huge festival of a benefit for the Anthrax.
Yeah, I think it's a fairly famous show too, right? That Anthrax benefit show.
Yeah, it might have been. It was our Violent Children's first show in maybe our first show ever, actually.
They have a t-shirt of that up at the Punk Rock Museum.
And oh, really?
I sent a photo to Elgin James, showrunner of the TV show Mayans, who's been on the podcast before. And he said that was his first show that he went to. That
Anthrax
benefit. It is like one of those, like, these things become so storied. And you look at the bands that were in that room, and obviously all of them.
I know.
Was Roger singing for Agnostic Front at that point, or is this pre?
No, I don't think so. It was James Contra.
Oh, that's awesome. That would be awesome. That must have been an incredible show.
Yeah, it was really cool. Lost for Alarm is also really good then. I'm not sure if Crowd played that show or not. I can't remember. But they were also one of my favorite bands. They were one of those bands, like the band that didn't get huge that you thought was going to be the next massive band. A lot of East Coast bands just never toured that much. They never break it out. They just didn't, you know, it was like an interesting time of music where they had local following, and there was just, it's hard to believe, but there was some type of viral thing that went out there, even though there was no internet, cell phones, texting. Somehow word got out. A band would press 3,000 records, 1,000. Most bands would press 1,000 records. Violent Children pressed 500 records, you know. But I'm sure, actually I'm not sure. Ignacio Firm probably at that time pressed 1,000. So it's generally like, oftentimes a band would break up by the time their record sold out. And that was it. The band ended, and then you never hear of them again. You can't find those records anywhere. And occasionally, Kevin Crowley from The Abuse stops by some records with, you know, 20 records he found in his basement, and they're like, oh, you know, stuff like that. So if you're a record collector, it was a good time to be around because, you know, 1 year would go by, the band would break up, no one's ever heard of this band. And now the record's a collector's item because there's every year the scene would grow bigger and bigger and bigger. At that time, again, it was like weird word of mouth stuff, and you couldn't find anything unless you were sort of there when it came out or the band sold it at a show. So it was sort of a cool time to be around. It was definitely cool for me later, probably in 85 when I got into record collecting, was a great time to be around because no one else was into record collecting. You could just like suck out everything dry from the city. Like some type of, it was almost like being a kid in a candy store and Willy Wonka's factory, you know?
Well, I think, you know, in particular with Kraut, because I think Unemployed had 3,000 pressed of the 7-inch, I remember.
Sure. Now, but you think about it, only a few years later, 2 years later, I was pressing 5,000 Warzone singles, and they'd all sell out. So that's how big the scene got over almost like overnight, 2 years' time or 3 years' time at the most. So it's hard to believe that the punk scene was – it's just started steadily growing and growing and growing.
Well, I think worldwide with you guys too. Like the influence of
you today. Yeah, worldwide with us.
When
yeah.
It spreads too, right? Like you say, it's viral. Like there's not
– Isn't it weird how it was viral then? How did people find out about it?
I think MRR played a huge part, which I guess is going to come up when we talk about record collecting and Tim Yohannan. But that magazine, like when I've had people on this podcast from different parts of the world, like that was our internet, like the letter section and all these things were like message boards. And like, this was like, this is what
Flipside too. Flipside and MRR. That was our go-to because it was the only thing that was reliable. Like it's going to come out every month. It's going to cover, you're going to get an idea of what's going on in the Midwest or in Southern California or Oregon, Sweden, back when I didn't even know what Sweden was, you know what I mean? Or where is, you know, Finland hardcore, Finnish hardcore, what the hell is, where's Finland? You know, just like a kid, I didn't know anything.
It gave it like a real global perspective at that point too, because like you're saying, like it was, everything was equal in punk. And like you look at mainstream pop music or mainstream pop culture, it's like very much like America, so goes America, so goes the world in a lot of ways. And like England obviously has an impact, and Canada, like English speaking countries certainly have a privilege. But in punk, when I got into it, like it was like, oh, Japanese punk is the best punk, or Finnish punk's the best punk, or Swedish punk. Like, and obviously American punk is in that conversation too, but like it was a global conversation as opposed to like so much other stuff that I was like into.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Those magazines definitely had an influence, and it was a way to check in. And I mean, that was one of my favorite pastimes in high school was read the scene reports, they called it. Do you remember that? Scene
reports. Absolutely.
Here's the Connecticut scene report or the, you know.
Well, those things eventually became like, and I mean the older issues, by the time I got into it, which is a few years later, into the 90s, those things became kind of like sacred texts, certain ones of those issues. Like the interview that Tim Yohannan did with you after you went had found Krishna became like kind of an infamous issue.
It was like an infamous issue, wasn't it?
That cover, like everything about it was, and like I think that like my perspective on that interview has changed a lot as like an outsider reading it. Yeah. I can only imagine your perspective as a person who lived through it.
I think my perspective was more not about what I said or even what he said, but we were really close, me and Tim. Like I really felt we were completely different. He was like a communist, chain smoker, meat eater. I was like a straight edge. He was 50 years old. I was like 19 years old. So we couldn't get as far apart in one sense, but at the same time, we felt like we were good friends, you know?
You guys had stayed there since like 85, right? Like,
yeah, I had been going there and hanging with him since 85. Yeah. I met everybody through Tim. I met Jello. I met Pusshead. I met, what's the guy from New York?
Michael Board.
Michael Board was a good friend of mine. I was really hurt by that, actually. His hatred for religion, which I get it, people hate religion, but I just felt like it was a little bit of a betrayal of friendship because it wasn't a straight interview. He put comments after things I said or something like that. And it really sort of undid our friendship, sadly.
It was also the intro that he put on it. And like,
truthfully, I can't even remember, but it was a time that I started like getting into Krishna, and he was just like a full on anarchist, atheist, meat eater, couldn't care less about, couldn't care less about that. And it just, yeah. Just thought this all religions are cults, and
I haven't read it in years, but when I read your book, I kind of thought about it a lot, and it really, I wonder what he would think now. And I would love to see an updated conversation between you and him now.
Yeah. I'd like to. Yeah. Me too.
Because I think like
it's hard to believe he'd be 100 years old now.
He would definitely,
right?
It would be a miracle of science.
And he was 50. Right. And I'm almost 60. You'd be 90 years old.
Well, that's the thing that I also put into context now that I've got kids, and I don't have 20 year olds. I got a 16 year old as my oldest, but like you're 20 years old. Here's a 50 year old that you've known since you were like a teenager.
Right.
Now sandbagging you in an interview.
Yeah.
And it's something that has global reach. Like, yeah.
But truthfully, I don't think it hurt me. It only sort of like all their criticism of Agnostic Front, and they really railed into Agnostic Front. I think Agnostic Front took it much worse than I did, but it only got Agnostic Front bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Matter of fact, I think Agnostic Front's claim, their fame, besides being such a good band at that time, was that Agnostic Front, I mean, Maximum Rock and Roll hated their guts, and they spoke bad about them every chance they had. But it was the same thing. He was, you know, they were like, anyway, we'll get into it. But
when Roger was on the show, I brought that up to him, and we talked about it for a while, and I think Roger was really hurt by the stuff Tim said on a personal level. And when you break it down, like on a personal politics, like if you strip away obviously all the isms around stuff, fundamentally they're pretty much doing the same thing, like trying to spread punk rock, trying to offer kids an alternate culture, reality that they can kind of escape into, that is punk culture, and they're looking out for their friends, and they're talking about how we should have mutual aid. And I really do feel like fundamentally they're kind of on the same page.
Yeah, it's true. I feel the same way. But anyway,
there's so much enough I gotta get to.
Is Maximum Rock and Roll still around?
There's a website still.
They say that was their biggest issue. At least that's what I remember them telling me at one point, that one with me was the biggest issue.
I'm sure
it drove up a lot of controversy for both sides.
It became like one of those things that I think everybody read at some point, right? Like you get into punk rock and an older punk person would give you that issue.
Or it's one of those things. It's when they stop talking about you, that's when you got to worry.
But it's also funny because here's you guys on a personal level having this like obviously very intense personal conversation, but here's how big this thing had gotten where there's right. all these outside eyeballs looking at this personal conversation. And that's sure. that's the amazing thing about punk to me, is because it's one of the few places as a young person that you're told you can kind of make this, and it is culturally valid. And look at how many people got involved in it. Like, you know, I did bring up the Vatican Commandos earlier by mistake, but the second 7-inch cover artwork is drawn by Rob Zombie. Like, there's like deep punk connections in all of pop culture.
The second Vatican Commandos record was drawn by Rob Zombie?
Yeah, the cover.
What's on the cover of that one again?
It's like a guy whose head's exploding.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's after Moby left the band.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was buddies with all those guys in Vatican Commandos. They were our buddies. You know, they lived in Darien, Connecticut. That was like pretty close to where I grew up. Oh, it's pretty good. Yeah, we played with them millions of times. Connecticut was great. I had great time, great memories in Connecticut.
Well, you mentioned going down to New York and like kind of seeing, you know, all these hardcore bands as they're starting to put out records. And I think you talk about, in fact, getting an Antidote test press in the book.
That was Michael Board gave that to me.
Oh, that's awesome.
Did I mention that in the book? Yeah, Michael Board was just sort of like, he knew I loved records. So he just said, here's some records you might want. And he just, I didn't even know what it was when he gave it to me. He gave me a bunch of records. And I put it on at home. I was like, this is the Antidote test pressing. Oh, my God. It was one of those mind-blowing, you know, it's like if I was a gold miner, I'd be rich right now. Instead, I was a record. Maybe I'd be rich, actually, if I was a record miner and didn't get rid of them all. But because they were all, I had pieces of gold in my hands. If you are a record collector and you knew the value of that stuff.
In the book, you talk about throwing them out at a show from the stage.
Yep. Not all of them, but a lot of them. A handful I sold, and I just donate the money to somebody I felt doing worthy things.
What did you do with the G.I. Joes?
Truthfully, Jordan ended up keeping a lot of that stuff.
Oh, so you got to get back on Jordan, get some of those G.I. Joes back, because I think those are worth a little bit of money now, too.
Yeah, how about some royalties, too? Get some of that back.
Yeah, because it's
you know,
funny.
What? I got to a certain point in my life when I was 22. I said, you know what? I'm just going to walk away from everything. And as much as I was like, I should have walked away and took points. But there was also something very, like a lot of people said, really, did you really have to surrender to God and give up your record collection? And the answer is no, you don't. But I will say there was like a freeing, in the same way you get when you sort of clean out your garage and you're like, should I hold on to this or clean out your closet? Like, should I hold on to this shirt that I, you know, it's a brand new LL Bean shirt, or should I get rid of it? And it's like, I've never worn it in 3 years or 5 years. Sometimes it's good just to clean house. And whatever it was at that point in my life, it was good to just let go of.
Yeah, like this.
Like it helped me with what I needed to do.
Yeah, this room that is an albatross. Every time I move, I'm tracking these records around with me.
Yeah, I get it. And there's something cool historically about it, too. But, you know, I'm always amazed at Harley Flanagan, because he kept such good art, despite his life, which wasn't like, you know, super stable. He kept so many cool documents of his life. Like, I literally have so little documenting my history. Even my own records. I don't have my own records.
I think a lot of that was his mom and having that stuff.
Maybe. She did keep that same apartment for a long time. I know I went there at one point. It was that apartment that he grew up in on 7th Street or wherever it was, 9th Street.
Yeah, because it's amazing his, you know, history. And you talk a lot about, I think you tell the story about running into the first time in the book. He's got like a spiked baseball bat or something, or he jumps. Yeah,
chair leg.
That's
chair leg with a nail in it. It's his weapon of choice at the time. He was very fashionable about what weapons he used.
Well, and that's the thing. You're going down to New York at a very wild time in the Lower East Side.
Yeah, you got to understand, it's like, it is a wild time. It's not like you're going at a time where there's danger at every step. And, yeah, I remember the first time I met Roger, too. I went into Vinny's apartment. Roger was there, met him. He took one of those little, ever see those fishing baseball bats? So like people used to, they caught a fish and they whacked the fish with. with the baseball. I remember Roger just putting one of those in his jacket. I was just like, okay, this is what's going on here. We're playing hardball. This is no longer Danbury, Connecticut. You were in the, everything was ghetto. Even Little Italy was ghetto. So it's people either had to be prey, defend themselves, or be the predator. And I think the punk scene was sort of like defend, if not be the predator, because they were the prey a lot of times because the punk scene was not in their neighborhood. That wasn't their neighborhood. That was the neighborhood of Hispanics, of the projects. And so oftentimes you were just prey.
Yeah, like Roger and Harley have both talked about it being on the show, that like it was a matter of survival. Like a lot of the violence that was in their lives was just sort of basic survival at that point. Like there wasn't really violence at shows in the beginning.
Yeah, not so bad. I mean, maybe a little. I don't know who you're kidding. It was more violence than I ever saw in my high school.
Well, it's interesting when you trace the history of the spread of violence at shows. And obviously Sid Vicious and the Pogoing in England first, but
I think that the punk was a lot less violent, like
definitely
old school punk. I think it got progressively worse after I got out of it.
I think you're right. It gets progressively worse, but
although LA was very bad, I will say the first time I went to LA, cause there were gangs, there was various gangs in LA, at the time. And that was a whole scene. And I've never seen anything like that when I first went to California.
Yeah, and then I think Henry Rollins in America's Hardcore talks about them going out to LA with the Teen Idols, seeing that, and then bringing that back to DC. And then you just kind of follow them bringing that to Boston, and then the Boston guys and the DC guys going up to New York and getting all the fights in New York in the early years.
Right.
And this sort of group of fairly feral street kids that were into punk rock.
I think it was more like fairly feral. Whereas I think it was a little bit more organized in California, this gang and this gang and this gang, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Like I think in terms of the gang.
Somehow
structure,
I always escaped any serious punishment.
Well, I think you talk about that in the book, and I think you say separately, Rabies and Harley, I think were both kind of protectors.
Rabies and Harley just liked me for some reason. So gave me sort of a golden ticket. Well, I sort of kept my head sort of low, sort of before Youth of Today started too. Kept under the radar.
A lot of people have talked about your charisma that have come on the show, Walter, you know, and just how infectious that was. And I think when Purcell was on the show, we talked about Reflex from Pain, your brief period in Reflex from Pain.
Yeah.
And how he knew from the first time he saw you that you just had this sort of magnetic front person energy.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and obviously that shows in the videos. So I don't mean to blow smoke on that one.
Well, I was the drummer in Violent Children, and it always killed me because I really wanted to sort of be the front man, because I was just like sort of a natural extrovert. And so when Reflex from Pain happened, these guys were already sort of next level. First of all, they were old men. They were 24 years old, you know, or no, they're like maybe 27 and I was 17. So that's a huge, now if you're 37 and I'm 47 or I'm 59, you're 49, it's no big deal. But when you're a 17 year old hanging out with a 27 year old, you're like, who are these losers? They're still in a band. They're 27 years old, but they were expert musicians, had incredible record collections. They were very cultured, you know, aficionados of good music. They had cars, they could drive, you know, one of them had their own house. And so I was like, wow, and then they knew because this punk scene was small. So they're friends with Ian, they're friends with, you know, Tim Johanna, and they're friends with, everybody in the Circle Jerks. So I remember Reflex from Pain's first show was like, yeah, we're going to play with the Circle Jerks. I was like, what? I'm going to play and open for the Circle Jerks in Philadelphia. I've never left Connecticut in New York practically. And so they set up all these big shows and, it was like amazing. It was like a dream come true. And then they kicked me out.
because of Malcolm Tent and Trash America. Is Malcolm Tent? No, Malcolm from Trash American Style.
Malcolm Tent. That was called. Malcolm that was Tent. His nickname. Now you got to understand, Malcolm, who started this huge. He really sort of pioneered the hardcore scene in Connecticut, which was from my hometown. Now, when I was living in that town, nothing happened. It was like it was the lamest town that I'd always dream of. I would so love to make this like a hardcore, you know, hot spot, holy place. And it just never happened. But when I moved away and went to New York City, Malcolm took his record store, which was in Newtown, Connecticut, moved it to Danbury. And then, you know, that's what you need. You need a record store. And it builds from that. And so many bands, Aware, Wide Awake. There were so many bands that came out of Connecticut. And they had a very, very good radio station at that time, WXCI, which was a college station from Danbury. And I think that recipe made like a huge burge. I remember going back and playing my hometown. It was packed. And I was like, I cannot believe this. Like, there was nobody here back then, you know?
Yeah, and that store ran, I guess it closed early 2000s, maybe?
And they were a good, it was a good store, too. They had great tons store. Of cool stuff. We, matter of fact, Shelter, I think there's pictures in my book of Shelter doing an in-store, like we're sitting around chanting or something back in the 92 or something like that.
Yeah, Malcolm, because of Malcolm, your period in Reflex from Pain was the first period that I heard, because that flexi that he did,
yeah,
which has you singing on it, there's more of that press than there is of that first 7-inch.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think there's twice as many, maybe more.
Or maybe they probably pressed 1,000 tops of that first one.
Yeah, and the limits on flexis in the 90s when that was put out were pretty high, the minimums. So there was quite a run on that 7-inch. Yeah. So that's the first stuff I heard, and I loved your stuff in that. I think your vocals on that session are amazing. Thanks. And those guys are your backing band in the first Shelter record, too, or later,
exactly.
Later on, right?
Exactly. They were just buddies. They became buddies of mine. And then when I wanted to do Shelter, it was not supposed to be a band. It was supposed to be sort of like a swan song, goodbye to the world. I'm going to India forever. And I just I felt like I needed to write a record and just sort of birth it. And that was the first Shelter, Perfection of Desire. And so I called them up. I wrote the record myself within a month. And I said, guys, can you come over here? I just want to practice this and record it. So one of the other Connecticut staples, this guy named Jeff Cudd, who's no longer alive, great guy, recorded it live for us at the Anthrax. Live meaning all the music was played at the same time on a portable 8-track. And then I came in and did vocals the same day. Very little overdubs, if any. Maybe one backup vocal track. Recorded the entire thing in a day. Mixed it in a day. And that was it. We only played together one day. One day.
One day.
Yeah, one day. That's it.
In the All Ages book that Revelation put out, Reflections on Straight Edge, Ian MacKay, there's a conversation with Ian MacKay. And in the conversation, he brings up an incident that happened at the 930 Club when Youth of Today played, and you went up to him and got upset with him that he had said vegetarianism was a tenet of Straight Edge in a Flipside interview. Do you remember this incident happening?
Don't remember it.
Okay. Goes into so much detail about this thing.
Who said this? Ian said this?
Ian says this in the Straight Edge book.
In the Straight Edge? I don't remember it. I didn't read it, but go on.
Were you ever anti-vegetarian at some point?
I don't think so. I mean, not that I can remember. Maybe I was. If he says I was, maybe. I don't know. I don't remember being anti-vegetarian. I remember not being a vegetarian at a certain point in my life.
Well, that's the thing that always struck me about it is that it just seems so contrary to how every other time I found you kind of as someone who was searching, and you always seem pretty open to different things in even old interviews that I would read with you. And that's why it never felt, I don't know, like it never felt like I was being indoctrinated into anything by Shelter music, because like I always felt like it was just about finding what you were looking for.
Mm. You know, I feel like, who knows? I mean, I was 19 years old. You're maybe when I met Ian, I think, and you know, who knows what could have come out of this mouth of mine. You know what I mean? You know, even youth of today didn't quite have a grip on who we were. Like, are we the mean straight edge guys? Are we the tough guys? Are we like the 7 seconds type of thoughtful, emotional, heartfelt guys? I think we started off sort of trying to be like these tough straight edge guys, but then very quickly, as soon as we very quickly realized we didn't want to go that route. You know, we dropped that ball.
It's funny you say that because that has come up on this show a lot. There's like this wave of hardcore dudes that your band name will come up. And I'm thinking of Chris Murphy from the band Sloan and Michael Ian Black, the comedian in particular, have brought up, oh, when I bring up Youth of Today, they're like, oh, I was never into that militant stuff. And there's like, and I never really found Youth of Today that militant in particular because
I mean, we have a song on our biggest record, Break Down the Walls, called Time to Forgive. I mean, come on. Yeah. The militant stuff came out later when Youth of Today broke up in the 90s.
And I think people conflate Project X and Judge with Youth of Today sometimes.
Well, that too. I think that's what Judge wanted to be. And Project X was almost comically extreme. You know what I mean? That's why they put their names on it. They wanted to be, I don't think they thought like that. They wanted to be extremists comically. It was like a caricature.
Yeah, and I always found that fit in a tradition in punk rock of parody punk rock records coming from punk rock bands.
Yeah, although I think Judge did want to sort of portray that, but it gave birth to all this next level, vegan, straight edge, violence, condoning violence. I never fit into that.
Well, how much awareness did you have of where this stuff was going?
Awareness whatsoever where anything was going.
No, I don't mean like back then, but like as it was kind of happening, like throughout the 90s, because Shelter's kind of like going parallel to this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we were friends with a lot of those guys, you know, that Earth Crisis and Vegan Reich. I remember those guys. I remember it all. But there was sort of like, and sometimes this happens with anybody on a good cause. There's a lot of anger, like really like furious anger. And at that point at Shelter, that wasn't my mood at all. It was more about self-betterment, serenity, controlling our senses, but not being hateful. Where sometimes in the name of even religion or healthy living or political stance, you can end up hating other tribes that are not like your tribe. And that sort of wasn't the philosophy I was embracing. I was embracing here are the tenets, here are the principles, here's the ethics, try them on and see if they fit you. But it wasn't a hateful thing. If you just said, you know, that's not my thing, it's not like, okay, we're going to demonize you now for not being like that. That wasn't it still is not my thing. I'm okay with people having different worldviews than me. You know, right now we have a polarized world where you hate your relatives because they believe different things than you. So anyway, even if you're into persuading people, I don't think hate is a good way to persuade a person, or shame is the good way to persuade a person.
Yeah, like it feels like that's a philosophy that goes back like to...
It was back forever.
But I mean, in particular with you, like you look at Nausea and YDL being on the compilation together. Like there's like a...
Being the compilation together. We all live in the same apartment.
I was going to say, you guys are all roommates.
It was Straight Ahead, YDL, Better, Death Before Dishonor, Nausea. We're all roommates.
Yeah. Like there's an idea which...
Like 14 of us in an apartment.
Yeah, which is something that's kind of hard, I think, even for myself to kind of conceive now. Like the idea of like all these people with kind of disparate, even by the 90s when I was getting into it. Like,
you know, I think it was just because we're all just such damn outcasts and we are connected by our freak flag that we waved. You know what I mean? I mean, you got to understand what the rest of the world was doing. The rest of the world hated us all. So we sort of bound together, and the Lower East Side back then was filled with everybody from weird gothic noise, alternative, hardcore punks, all different, and tie that into weird religions and weird diets. And I mean, vegetarianism was weird. Yoga was weird. All that stuff is all alternative in 1985. So it's not like, yeah, hip hop was weird and underground. Graffiti was weird and underground. I mean, I just went by the Banksy Museum. I'm thinking, oh, that was the guy that, you know, he was like one of us criminals, you know, criminal weirdos. Keith Haring was like a criminal hero millionaire, was soon to be millionaire. And some people were just as criminal, just as crazy, such just as artistic, and either got arrested or died or overdosed.
Ray, thank you so much for coming back on the show, because I feel like if I put out like a 40-minute episode with you as the episode, people would be very upset with me because this one's been building for so long.
You're asking good questions, so it's making me dig around deep into places that people never ask me, so.
Well, hopefully I can continue that. Last time we talked a little bit about Ian, and I've always kind of been struck by, and I think he even talks about this in the All Ages book, how he always felt that the youth crew thing, and certainly Youth of Today being kind of at the forefront of that, was more influenced by SSD than Minor Threat. Is that a fair assessment in your mind?
I think that's a fair assessment. We're inspired by, you know, I think Al really sort of summed it up, because there was like a feeling towards like me and Purcell were like athletes, and you know, you usually don't think of athletes in the punk scene. You think of the opposite. You think of people just, you know, smoking or drinking or lethargic, you know. At least that's what like the New York scene was. So when we saw these pictures of Al, who is like a bodybuilder, and a, you know, that like sort of resonates with me. It sort of gave like a thumbs up, like, you know, you can be clean living, you can be into health and still like this type of music. So, I mean, of course we liked Minor Threat, but both the sound and sort of the straightforwardness of SSD really like gripped us. And if not, the branding of SSD sort of gripped us more.
It's interesting because, like, and when Al was on the show, the times he was on the show, we kind of talked about it. Rest in peace, of course, to Al.
Yeah.
He really wasn't a fan of punk. Like, for him, it was hardcore. And it's kind of like SSD is almost like the first kind of pure hardcore band in that way, whereas Minor Threat's still kind of coming out of like a punk rock tradition.
Yeah. Me and Purcell also came out of punk as well. I don't know if maybe Al was born out of like rock and metal too. I was never really into rock and metal. Maybe for a short time when I started realizing that there are these parallel bands like Metallica, first started like in 1984, say, or 83. Bands like Tank, bands like Anthrax's first release and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, this is sort of like interesting. But I never grew up listening to metal. I never grew up to listening to Iron Maiden or things like that. So when I watched DYS and SSD sort of pivot and take that turn, I sort of threw my hands up and said, no way. But we sort of grew up in the older branding of SSD and what they were. And that sort of Youth of Today sort of imprinted from that.
There's almost like an unconscious passing of the torch moment too, by them going metal and by, I guess, 7 Seconds going kind of towards kind of their direction, where it kind of clears the way for you guys.
And it all happened at the exact same time, because I think people weren't done with that genre of music yet. And of course, both those bands were perhaps the most two, you called it, like probably the most two influential bands on us, SSD and 7 Seconds. Of course, 7 Seconds for the lyrics and the attitudes, and SSD for the stance and for the straightforwardness and for the almost like the brand.
Yeah, and certainly the sound that you guys kind of carry on. It's interesting you look at like that period of 83 to 85 as being like a dropping off period for like the first wave of American hardcore. Dinosaur Jr. kind of comes out of Deep Wound, right?
Like, yeah, it was a dropping off. It was a sad time for us, and there was a sort of a spontaneous feeling as the band started like figuring out what we wanted to accomplish. We witnessed everything crumbling around us, and we said, you know what? No, we're going to keep it simple. We're going to make it as generic as possible. We don't believe that it's evolving to sound more and more like metal or more like U2. We want to sound like the real AB. Our favorite records were like the ABCs of hardcore, which were The Abused, the first Ignacio Front single, you know, the first SSD album, the first Negative Approach single. To us, like, that was the golden heyday. Why go anywhere else from there? Let, you know, why move on? That stuff needs to be explored more. And so that's we're going to keep it so simple and so generic. We took the name Youth of Today from an Avenger song, We Are the One. And that's what we sort of ran with. And sure enough, there were more people that just really wanted that sound.
There's a Glenn Branca compilation that I picked up years ago in Florida that's just got like 1 or 2 minute songs by every band. And I think it came out in 83, 84, but Thurston Moore's song on that is called Youth of Today.
Oh yeah. Thurston Moore had a really weird, peculiar obsession with Straight Edge in 1985. He collected every Straight Edge record. I don't know if he did it as a novelty or if he was into it or mocking it. I'm not sure, but
I think he legitimately loves it. Like, he and I have talked about Youth of Today extensively. Like, he listens to that stuff. I think it's like
we were all in the same scene back then. It was all sort of the same scene, and I know for a fact because he used to shop at some records and he used to pick up all these records back then.
And he's playing guitar in Even Worse too for like period of time.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, like I think he's on the first single. But he certainly played in them for a few years. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's interesting when you look at New York, how you've got like all these kind of like parallel scenes going, but then I don't know, maybe I'm misreading, but by 87, it feels like everything's gotten too big or just imploded because of whatever reason. And that's kind of like, I guess the rise of, or you guys have already risen, but that's kind of like your time.
Yeah. I think, it was still mixed up in 87. Maybe a couple years later, things started to diverge in different directions. For some reason, there could still be you could still get along and find some type of camaraderie in bands that were politically completely different from you, musically very different from you, the way you dressed very different from you. Because as I said on the first part of this episode, like, we were bound by our freak flag. You know, we all were sort of outsiders from the mainstream. And perhaps maybe when some of this music became mainstream, that's when we all sort of went our own ways. As hip hop picked up and as speed metal picked up and as more alternative rock picked up. Otherwise, if you think about it, like Caroline Records, we had Youth of Today, we had White Zombie, we had Smashing Pumpkins, we had
Unrest.
Unrest, right?
Yeah.
Caroline Records had a bunch of interesting, unique bands that all sort of somehow jived together as sort of like we all belong together.
It's now that we've got like a few years distance from that time period, it's interesting to kind of look at how that cycle replicates itself over and over again, kind of throughout this music, where you have this wave of people that are like, no, we're the hardcore. And then as they get older, people's tastes change, they diversify, they might not get out of it, but just things change. And then you have this new wave of kids that are like, no, we're the hardcore. And then the cycle will repeat. But it's almost like the life cycle of being a part of this thing, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Was there a strategy in putting out Warzone as the first 7-inch on Revelation?
No, because Revelation had no strategy. It was just a desire to document that band and with that, perhaps maybe some of the other bands that are coming out, because there was a recognition that this is sort of a special time that's happening. and all these bands. And there was a recognition that these bands are so temporary. They'll just come and go within a year, 2 years. We saw it happen. And so sort of me as sort of a historian, a sonic historian, I was like, we really should really make something tangible, like a tangible sonic yearbook for these bands that are just going to be forgotten about. And so they were breaking up. And I told Ray Bees, look, we can't just let this band break up. You know, you guys have made an impact. Let's put out a record. Give me all your demo tapes. Find your best demo tapes. Give them to me. We'll make them into a record and we'll put it out. And we'll, can't remember how we made a deal with him, with them, but I just did it sort of not as a, let's start a business. It was like the last thing on my mind. It was more like, let's just like have something for posterity's sake, put out a cool package. And then we'll always remember Warzone. That's what it was. And under the assumption that this band is going to break up. But once the record came out, there was some like new enthusiasm with the band. They said, well, we've decided to stay together. And that was, you know, how it continued on. And yeah, it was sort of cool. Warzone was definitely fun.
Was Ray Bees straight edge before or after? Because you've got, I think that's in the book, you talk about him showing up and being like, I'm straight edge.
He was never straight edge at all.
Or he talked about being straight edge.
He was never straight edge at all. But in my book, when he came, when Youth of Today, he told me that Youth of Today really inspired him to go straight edge. And I think he had a very, very like sordid, you know, relationship with drugs. And so I think hearing about straight edge and seeing Youth of Today, it might have like inspired him to, you know what, I'm going to do it. But I think also people like Ray, I never got into drugs myself or smoking or drinking. If I did, it was just a tiny bit in high school. So for me to give it up was not a big deal because I just never gave it up. I never started it. I think for people who have like really indulged themselves, sometimes it's harder and harder to give it up because you have relationships with people and places and things that are like your friends. And so I think perhaps it was a little harder for him to give it up. I'm not quite sure if he stayed straight edge till the end or something. But he did give it up for that period of time that I was sort of friends with him. And so, yeah, it was sort of like shocking because he was not that guy. And so when he was like, yeah, I'm straight edge. And then Todd Youth also was like, yeah, I'm straight edge too. I was like, what? You guys? Out of all the guys, like you're straight edge? I was like, all right. What more? All the power to you. And it almost seemed like everybody was, I mean, it was just sort of fashionable to be straight edge at that time. But it was a sort of a healthy fashion, whatever it be. I could have think of a lot worse trends to get into at that time.
Oh my God. Like you look at eating Tide Pods or huffing solvents, you know, feel like.
Yeah. Those were all trends, you know?
Yeah. There's even probably more terrifying trends I'm worried about my kids falling into now. Yeah. If they could get into straight edge. And
right. Why not?
What a great thing. Even if it's just a temporary thing for someone, like what a great thing to find.
It could save you. Some kids just really quickly get into addiction. You know, some people, it's not a big deal. They have an easy dance with drugs. It doesn't bother them. They get out scot-free. Some people, it takes them down quick I have a cousin too. It's just got into it very young. It grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And from the time he was 12, he was on heroin. You know, it just wrecked his entire life. So it's one of these things like you can make fun of it. You can mock it. It was silly. It's who do you guys think you are? What do you think you're better than everybody else? But some people had really saved their life.
Oh, definitely. People that come on the show talk about it too. And I think it still does. Like there's people I know that found sobriety and then found straight edge and that gave them strength in their sobriety.
Yeah.
I say this as a confirmed pothead, but you know, you'd have the mushroom story in the book. And have you ever been interested about the connection of psychedelics further than that with spirituality? Like there's such a tradition of,
Back then, not so much. Nowadays, perhaps for something like a person dying or a person, I don't necessarily depend on like I think it definitely helps you get to different realms, and I've heard positive experiences about it. I just feel like I don't need that to contact to be in connection with God. I can see how it could make you see other world. I could see how it could assist you into having an expanded vision, if done under proper circumstances. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but I could understand how people get a lot from doing it. But I've also heard about pitfalls from people doing it too, and it screws up their, I don't know if it's their neurological system, or sometimes they can never recover from certain things. I just don't think you need something outside of yourself to find spirit, not even a church per se. But that being said, I'm very interested to read the micro and macro doses for hallucinogenics for people suffering from intense trauma or people suffering from incredible amounts of pain due to cancer or chronic pain. And I've heard positive reports taking it medicinally, but I haven't experimented or know enough about it to even recommend it. But it's interesting. I mean, I don't think it's any worse than taking tons of morphine, you know. There have been reports that I've heard even Krishna devotees tell me about the, you know, truthfully, I don't know enough about it, but that, what's it called? It's that type of oil you get from cannabis.
Oh, Rick Simpson oil, it's called.
Yeah, Rick Simpson oil, how that absolutely can actually reverse cancer. So these are things like, if you're doing it to escape or medicate your pain of existence so you don't have to face your problems, that's a problem. But if you're doing it as a medicine to reverse cancer or something like that, I don't think that's a problem. I think that's, you know, is it better than, worse than taking chemotherapy? You know, you have to look at it with, you know, adult lenses on, and what's the initial reason why we don't do those things. But as far as spirituality goes, I can understand how it can do these mind-altering things, especially if you're in a groove and you see everything the same. And then people take these things and they report, wow, I see myself as separate from my body. I see how this world, we're obsessed with temporary things. But I also feel like God doesn't have to use a mushroom or ayahuasca to show you those things as well. And it's ultimately, it's God or your higher power or your source or the universe or Christ or Buddha or Krishna is behind those herbs, drugs, cannabis, whatever, to give those visions. So I don't think it has to be that. I mentioned this phrase in the book I heard from a mentor, that don't mistake the flute from the player of the flute, which I thought was very sanguine and an interesting way to look at it, and poetic also.
Yeah, it's like we tend to look at the messenger and not the message.
Yeah, exactly.
In our world.
Or the opposite, that we tend to look at the message but not the messenger. Where is it actually coming from in the first place?
Yeah, or privilege the messenger over the message, I should say.
Right, okay, yeah.
Because and it's interesting when how much ownership people can take over other people's lives. And I brought up last time seeing you be interviewed before, and the bass player of my band Fucked Up interviewed you years ago at a Better Than 1,000 show in Buffalo. And there was sort of an older punk rocker who got in on the interview and maybe derailed the interview is one way of looking at it. Just throwing out challenges at you. Largely about Krishna. And it feels like you probably have had to deal with someone like that, be it about Straight Edge or then about Krishna, at every single show you've played, up to a certain point. I imagine now it's...
Eh, I still deal with it. But, you know, after a while, things start to prove themselves, you know. I think in time, people start to say, you know what? I am 48 years old. Maybe I should start living clean. Being careful about my, you know, I've got children. I got to be careful what I put in my body. I got to be careful about heart disease. I got to be careful about, once you start having kids, you start thinking twice about drinking, you know, 5 beers a day. If you're still drinking 5 beers a day and you got little children and you're married, you might want to question, is this the best example I'm setting up for my kids? And maybe I could have a relationship with 5 beers a day, but maybe I have a child that can't. because, and if I'm going to be the person that my child looks up to, maybe I got to be really careful about what I'm setting an example for. So I think these things that once were sort of appearing like sophomoric are perhaps we start to re-examine as we get older. You know, even now at 59, I'm thinking, I got to be careful about my health and my well-being and my, because there's people that depend on me and people that love me and I want to, and people I'm trying to set an example for. And I want, I don't want to, I'd rather be the oldest person in the gym instead of the youngest person in the funeral, you know? So we start to think like that as we get older and all these things that sound sort of childish and silly and, who do these guys think they are? They start to sober up in spirituality too. I'm not saying now it's time to join a church or an ashram or anything, but those questions of life, like what is my life about? What is purpose? What am I here to do? What is my contribution? What's a home run? You know, for my work, is it collecting stuff? Is it to get a lot of money? Is it to have a family? Is it to pop out a couple kids? Is it to save? Is it to be charitable? What is the goal of my existence? And I think these are things that just thoughtful people, they ask themselves these questions. And it sort of gnaws on their heart and on their mind, like, why am I here? And if we don't ask them, we end up asking them, and I'm sure, you know, and you can also vouch for this, as you and I get older, we know more people that have died. We know more people, right? If my son gets a heart attack, who's 18 years old, everyone would be shocked. If I got a heart attack, people would say, yeah, it's too bad. Because this is like the age that people get heart attacks. People drop dead. They get an aneurysm. They get cancer. You know, I mean, this is that window of like superior health where I can eat Domino's pizza, drink Coca-Cola and still look great. Those days are over. Now is a time that if I'm not very careful about my diet, my health, my exercise, everything, your body, it takes toll on your body immediately. And people say, well, age is, you know, is just a number. You tell that to my knees. You tell that to my lower back. You know, age is a number, and it also reflects in your lifestyle. And we have the opportunity to, like, take care of the gifts we've been given, like our body and our mind and our thoughts, or just trash it, just like a piece of, like a rent-a-car. And we can do that as well. So I think I have been dealing with this, but hopefully after 35, people are all facing off with these type of questions. Spirituality, purpose, the why am I here question, how I want to live, some healthy parameters to set for my family, to set a good example. Or else life's become sort of depressing. And we talked to Tim Yohannan, who was, you know, when I knew him, he was single. He was a chain smoker. He drank. He wasn't a vegetarian. And although he was a nice guy, he was sort of, besides his magazine, it all seemed sort of purposeless and dystopian, that type of existence. And
I don't know. I mean, I don't want to cut you off, but I push back on that a little bit because I think he did have a purpose. Like, it doesn't seem pleasant, but he kind of like lived this very unhealthy monkey-in like existence where he was in service of punk. Like, I really do feel like he was dedicating his life to this. So you're right. Like, I feel they're definitely, but I do think he did have a purpose and that this was the purpose.
I think because of that, it gave him a little bit more drive. But if that's all you have to do, if that's all, for me, if that's all I believe in purpose fuels a person more than anything. But then you got to analyze, well, what's the purpose? Like, is that the most noble purpose you could choose? Does it help the overall good of the being? It didn't help his health. It didn't help his, I don't think it helped his thoughts or his serenity or his peace of mind. He had no dependents really, except for, you know, people who were part of his team. But was it setting the best example for his team members? Like, is this the way to live? And I would ask that about myself And I'd ask that if that's what I want my kids to have. So he didn't have that thing with having children. And I'm not trying to badmouth a person who can't defend themselves. Is not alive any longer. But I've thought about, it's not like I haven't thought about, you know what? There might just be nothing. Who cares? I've thought that path out really thoroughly. And it's not what I want to wake up to in the morning, you know, because ultimately that purpose of, in a world where there is nothing, who gives a shit about purpose and who gives a shit about serving punk or serving anything for that matter? If you really want to boil it down to the whole world is purposeless, we're just flapping around for a few years until we die, try to do some things that that make you happy. If that's it, I've even thought that one out through, what will actually make me the happiest? And I think that's important to really think. If that is all there is, you know, then you really got to think about what genuinely makes you happy.
I feel like punk, and certainly the maximum rock and roll version of punk, when it actually got into like the political thing, gives sort of like a secular religion. And created sort of a secular religion for people where it did give purpose. If you don't have a spiritual inkling beyond this physical world.
I definitely agree with you. It does become your religion. And you have your saints and prophets and your holy books and your ethics.
100%.
And your devils as well. You have the devil in the maybe Tim's, Hannon's case, that would be the capitalist or the nationalist or the agnostic fronts of the world. They would represent his devil. But but anyway, I don't really want to talk shit about Tim Yohannan. Whatever went on, I actually liked the guy. I tried to see the good in Tim Yohannan, and he was helpful and friendly to me.
I also feel
most of our relationship.
And I feel like this is challenging the rhetoric a little bit. Like, I feel like this is something where we get a chance to, like, certainly in a non-confrontational, non-violent way, with a historical distance now, but like, we can kind of talk about this stuff and draw it out. And I think Tim Yohannan, I never got to meet him. Like, we got out there after he had passed away for the first time, but it certainly feels like from what he wrote that this would be something he would want to have as sort of this conversation. Like, he would bring barbecue to Maximum Rock and Roll meetings where every single person was vegetarian except for him and eat barbecue in front of everybody. Like, he clearly, like you're saying with yourself, like, had room for other opinions than his own, even though he sometimes bullied them a little bit when they didn't follow his own.
Yeah.
You're certainly someone that has, you know, as we talked about last time with the compilation and the bands that were on that compilation, your roommates, you know, you found someone who's found an ability to be in rooms with different people with different kinds of thoughts than yourself. And always, it seems like you're someone who's been, like, even in the book, when you talk about being hanging out with the Christian kids in high school, just being around people that were searching for something.
Yeah.
It feels like now we're in a world where it's been largely divided and you're not really able to search in the same way. Like, you have to pick your team a little bit at this point.
Yeah. It's sort of sad. You're expected to, be on a particular team, and there's no room for black and there's no room for nuance or shades of gray. And it's unfortunate, and I don't prescribe to it.
But there's some people that I don't know, this sounds like very elitist to say, but you look at some of this information that we've all been able to have access to and we've all been playing with for years, certainly in punk rock, like and you look at the larger world and the ramifications of people that can't necessarily handle this. I don't know, I'm not really articulating this properly, but I feel like there's certain things that have manifested in the last few years, which show that the punk rock experiment of all of us coexisting peacefully can't necessarily happen in the real world because there's people that can't coexist peacefully, right? Like, there's people that would follow certain bands' ideologies that are Nazis or racists in real life, you know? And it feels like this can't be extended to the greater world. Like YDL and Nausea coexisting in an apartment together
is something that wouldn't happen now or couldn't happen now.
Yes, I know. It just couldn't happen. We become more and more intolerant of and less of finding some common ground. But I think they weren't both players in that YDL and Nausea weren't like they weren't extremists. They just had they're very similar in so many ways, more than their differences. And they were just children, you know. They were just children. Literally, like everybody was under 22 practically, and YDL were like young teenagers, not old teenagers, like young teenagers at the time. I think people just wanted to be more than they wanted to identify with some political party. They wanted to identify just as separate than the masses, and that's sort of was what bound people together. Nowadays, I think we just we've just created an us and them. And it's not going to get better unless we can start seeing people as individuals. And everybody's an individual. We want to write off and cancel everybody, but people are individuals. And we should take people as individuals and treat people with dignity. And generally, I find that most people aren't extremists. Most people actually are good people that want to do what's good, and they have a different way of going about it. You will find people that are they're always going to be racists, and there's always going to be these crazy anarchists. Most people are somewhere the pendulum's falling more in the middle, and we're trying to like say no, it's extreme. It's not that extreme. Most people fall in the middle. And there's a lot of common ground, but the fact is we're focusing on the differences instead of focusing on what we have in common. And I find the way to move forward in this world is see people and see what we have in common. And if you want some type of peace, you got to figure out what you have in common with people. And you have to hear people's side of the story. You have to try to understand people before you ask them to understand you. You have to be a little understanding, like, why do they hate us? And then when you sort of understand, oh, I could understand that's how you hear. And then they have to be able to say, well, why do you hate us? And when both people can be empathetic and hear the other person's side first and really understand the other position, we'll realize, oh, we actually have a lot in common here. But we won't do that. We just dig in our heels. This is what I hate about you. Really? This is what I hate about you. And it just festers, and it doesn't help with social media, doesn't help with these corporate-sponsored, political news channels that just, like, they thrive on the differences, and you get more clicks, and it's clickbait, and it's horrible. And really, we have just a bunch of people. We're just training people in hate, and no one's going to win from it. No one's going to win from it.
I think, though, there's like, and I don't know these people personally, but like in the groups that they align themselves with or have been aligned with historically now, I think there's more tolerance on the Nausea side than on that YDL side, though. Like at the core, right? One is like thanking Screwdriver and one's not.
Are we talking about the music scene or the pop?
I'm taking it to weird levels, right? I'm on like a psychedelic plane right now with this thing, but okay. I'm like trying to extend it to the larger.
I don't know what the music scene is like.
Well, I'm not saying the music scene. I'm talking about like ideologically, like if we're talking about, like an extreme left or an extreme right position, right? Like I think there's more tolerance on that left position.
Whatever it is, it makes no difference because I'm not looking at them as sides any longer. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at them as individuals. So if people individually can see the good in other people, if they can be understanding before they're asked to understand, then I think that that's where you're going to find peace. You're not going to find it in being an extremist and just saying, "Well, I'm being extreme. This is why you're wrong," or "I'm being more open-minded than you. This is why you're wrong." It's just not going to find peace. You're going to have this ongoing tension forever. And that's okay. You can have that as well. I just don't. I think you got to search for people's commonality if you want some type of peace. And let's face it, are you going to convince a person or persuade a person by hating them? No, you just turn them against you. There's better ways to persuade people.
Well, let's find
from understanding them.
Well, let's find some common ground right now. Why'd you hate the Misguided 7-inch so much? That thing's amazing.
I just thought it was not that good.
I think it's a great record. I've heard you trash it on the Revelation podcast, and I was like, what?
Yeah, the Misguided. I didn't think anybody liked them.
Oh, they've got a fan base. They became Das Damen, too.
I didn't like them either.
Well,
I was friends with the drummer, Lyle. Or Kyle? Lyle?
Lyle.
Lyle. He was cool. Yeah, I just didn't like him.
A Das Damen label mate that I've heard that you did really like was Blast. And when Purcell was on the show, he talked about
how Blast was on Das Damen?
They were on SST. Sorry, together. They were label mates.
Oh, I get you. Blast. I like Blast.
Yeah, Ray, when Purcell was on the show, he said that at a certain point, you wanted to take Youth of Today in a Blast direction.
Maybe.
And that led to the breakup the first time?
I don't know why we broke up that first time, but I remember thinking about taking it to a new direction like that. The problem was I was the songwriter, but I didn't play any instruments, so I couldn't even figure out how to make it sound like that. It was very easy for me to write hardcore. It's very formulaic. I don't know if there's a word, but formulaic.
Formulaic.
Formulaic. So in that case, it was easy. But to write blast music, I don't know. I couldn't quite. I'm not really a musician, truthfully.
I say this as a lead singer in a band who can't play an instrument myself. I think part of our evolutionary cycle is a certain point we all want to get our Rollins on. And I feel like Purcell and I came to maybe the conclusion that this was your period of trying to get your Rollins on in the band, which is a perfectly natural thing to do.
Blast, what does get your Rollins on mean?
You know, be the front person, you know, and that's what, you know, you can kind of, you know, groove it out a little bit more as a front person in a band like Blast than you could in like Youth of Today, where you're part of this sort of hardcore explosion that's happening on stage.
I don't know if that was the reason why I wanted to get my Blast on, because I definitely feel like I was the front person in Youth of Today. It was my thing. It was like what I treasured, what my joy. I just think I wanted to sort of figure out another direction to take the sound in. And I'm not sure if it broke us up or not, but I think there was a pause in Youth of Today. I can't remember why.
In the book, you talk about spending a lot of time extensively traveling around India. Did you ever encounter punk rock scenes in India when you were traveling?
You know, there was one chapter in the book there was a few chapters in the book that were taken out. And one of them I was in, if you look at India, it looks almost like a mini South America. But if you look higher in India, it goes around this Bay of Bengal. And it wraps around, you have Bhutan, you have Nagaland and Manipur. There are all these Indian states that don't look like they're part of the main part of India. But if you actually look at a map, India wraps all the way around and eventually goes to, you know, Myanmar and Thailand and Cambodia and Laos and stuff like that. So there was a time, and this place like these places are very, very different than regular India. And I had a chance at a young age to go to Manipur, Manipur. And you couldn't get there at that time, but I had some special inn. And I got to go to this sort of place where you needed a special visa just to go to this state. And everybody practiced Krishna consciousness there. Everybody worshiped Krishna there. So it was a very cool place to go, but I knew this Swami from that area, and he was like a PhD, but he got his PhD in the United States. And they were really educated in these really refined Indian arts, like martial arts and fighting with axes and swords, music, playing the drum in this beautiful way, Manipur dance, which was one of the classical Indian dances, and incredible, out of this world cooking, that you no one's ever eaten before. It's like this type of food. It's not Indian food. It's sort of like black rice, lotus root. It was just like fascinating. And I had the good fortune to go there for about 10 days and with another hardcore guy. And one time we were driving around with this very sophisticated Swami. Like I said, he was like a PhD from a very refined family and very respected within the Manipur government. And we're driving around on a motor rickshaw and we see a big poster and it says, "Go, come see Phoenix, Manipur's only thrash band." And me and Tony, this was Tony, he was like the first bass player in 108, the band 108. And I said, and Tony said, "Oh my God, it's, look at that poster. It's a thrash band." And the Swami looked at us, he goes, "What are you talking about?" And he pulled over the motor rickshaw. And I said, well, Swamiji, this is the same type of music we play. It's like thrash music. And then he sent his student out to go find me this band Phoenix. And so the student ran off. We continue on. And later in the evening, I got this knock on my door. Now, the people in Manipur, the very beautiful faces, very very Asian-looking faces, golden skin, very traditional in their clothing, which is different from Indian clothing. The women wear like a long sarong, long jet black hair. And anyway, later in the day, someone came to our room and said, "You know, your friends are here to see you." And I was like, "My friends? I don't have any friends here." He goes, "They're waiting downstairs to see you." I was like, "My friends? Me? Are you like, I'm the only white person in this entire state." And so we go downstairs, and sure enough, it was the band Phoenix. They looked like the same beautiful Manipur faces, and except with teased out black hair, motorcycle jackets, wearing like jams shorts and, you know, combat boots. And I was like, "Oh my God, this must be Phoenix." So for the next 3 days, we hung out with Phoenix, Manipur's only thrash band. And although the story got cut out of my book, the photo got left in my book. So if you have a copy of my book, you will see Phoenix, me hanging out with a thrash band from Manipur. And that, the photo got left in.
That's awesome.
Otherwise, I've never heard of a thrash band at that time. Although there are some straight edge kids from Mumbai that follow me.
Yeah, it's interesting because like that's the one place that I've haven't heard any punk from, and I've got records from everywhere, compilations, tapes, and stuff. India's the one place that I haven't really heard too much punk out of there, and so I've always been interested.
There's definitely a metal scene, I know.
I've heard about the metal stuff, yeah. A little bit more. One person you do talk about in the book, but I just wanted to talk to you about it a little bit more because I think she's incredible, is Polystyrene.
Oh, yeah. I just met in January Laura Logic as well, who was the first bass player of the X-Ray Specs when she was 15. She also got into Krishna, and then she sort of like lived in an ashram for most of her life. She was like married to a Krishna guy, had a kid. And now I became very, very close with Laura. But Polystyrene, you want me to tell that story or you want to just...
Well, it's in the book too, but like, no, absolutely. You can talk as you know, you talk about it in the book, how you met her through Krishna. And I think actually in the documentary, her and Laura reconnected through Krishna eventually because they had a falling out at a certain...
Yeah, I think they had a falling out and they reconnected. Yeah. And they both randomly got into Krishna as well. But I met her, and you got to understand, first of all, the X-Ray Specs were a very big influential band on me and Porcel. We each, I think each of us had all of their singles, you know, the LP. I had the poster of her on my wall when I was growing up. I loved the X-Ray Specs. And, you know, to me, it was sort of like this band. It was defunct. I'll never hear from her again. And it was one of these Sid Vicious's of a woman Sid Vicious, so to speak, was in that scene before, you know, while I was still a Cub Scout. So I had no connection with them. But then when I started getting into Krishna and the Eastern philosophy, someone told me, "Oh, she's into Krishna too." I was like, "Really?" But sure enough, I was on my way to India. I laid over in London and I wanted to stay at the temple there. for a few nights. So I stayed in Soho Street, and I went to the temple, and I was sitting in the temple room and chanting, meditating on my malas, my beads. And in walks this sort of eclectic looking cool lady and sat down next to me, and she started sitting there and just chanting on beads as well. It was like the afternoon in Soho Street, and I immediately clicked into fanboy mode and was like, oh my God, this is polystyrene. I cannot believe it. And so I didn't want to say anything because I was embarrassed. But as she was leaving, I was like, well, why not say anything? People come up to me all the time and say, hey, Ray Capo, thanks so much for that record. It changed my life. I'm going to say something. So I just broke meditation, ran up to her and say, listen, I don't know, you know, you probably hear this a lot, but I grew up loving your band. You meant so much to me. I didn't really understand that you were into being a devotee of Lord Krishna. But anyway, we had this great conversation, and then I ended up spending the afternoon with her the next day as well. And she became a nice friend. And when Youth of Today ended up coming back around on tour the following year, when I got back from India, we stayed at her house. So it was nice. I'm glad we got to connect with her and give her big prompts. Since then, I've spoken to her daughter, who released the film about her. But she, yeah, another sort of cool, influential person in my life, I'd say. And now I'm glad I got to hear from Laura, and glad I got that connection with her too. She's still a prolific songwriter and a very, very cool lady as well.
And those Essential Logic records are awesome too.
Essential Logic records, yes.
Yeah.
Did polystyrene play on those?
No. I think it's after they had she left.
Okay. The Essential Logic is just Laura. Logic.
Yeah. Okay. And they're kind of like, they're part of that really interesting, but like much more DIY kind of post punk fallout scene in London.
Yeah.
Fantastic band. Yeah. When Walter was on the show, he talked about when you guys stayed there.
Yeah, that's right. Walter and Sammy. Purcell did not stay with us for some reason. We were just joking about this. Like, how did you not get in on that? And I think, I don't know what it was, but me and Walter and Sammy did.
That wasn't the tour with Jail Cell Recipes, though, right? That was the tour.
I can't remember.
Okay. Maybe. Jail Cell Recipes toured with you guys, and then the next tour they did, or shortly thereafter, they did a tour with Green Day. So they're the link between Youth of Day and Green Day.
Interesting.
I tell you, it all comes together, Ray, on this podcast. That's what we're trying to do on this thing.
You're connecting the dots.
That's what I'm like, you know, that's like we talked about last time, how things go viral in this scene. Like there's like this sort of interconnectedness that goes around the world that has nothing to do with capitalism or social media. It's just by a shared love of this music. And that's why I was pushing back on that Tim Yohannan thing, is because I think what he did, like obviously taking out all the personal stuff with you, which we talked about last time, and certainly some of the stuff with Roger, which Roger and I have talked about too. I think just building this network, giving his life to building this thing, DIY punk, it gave us some way of subverting everything around us. And I think it will continue, because it's always going to give kids. There'll always be a new generation of kids that are like, no, we're the hardcore, and will find agency and voice, and it's global. Like I met people from all over the world that have been.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see where it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, I've kept you for a long time between this time and last time, and I don't want to keep you all day because I still have pages and pages more questions for you. Anytime you want to come back on this show, Ray, you are always welcome.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks. I hope you got all your questions out today.